Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. In this installment of our series of interviews with Wisconsin candidates for governor, we talk with Green Party candidate Michael White. He's running against Libertarian Phil Anderson, Wisconsin Party candidate Arnie Enns, Democrat Tony Evers, Independent candidate Maggie Turnbull, and Republican incumbent Scott Walker. What is the top issue that you want the next governor to focus on? What questions do you have for Dr. Michael White? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Ideas@WPR.org is our email address. You can also reach us on Twitter. Look for @WPRMornings. Dr. Michael White is the Green Party candidate for governor of Wisconsin and a dermatologist. Dr. White, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why do you want to be governor of Wisconsin?
Well, the number one issue is, for me, climate change and the ongoing environmental disaster that we face in Wisconsin, nationally, and across the planet. To put it in very simple terms, our lifeboat is sinking, and we're spending a lot of time arguing about who's in control as opposed to bailing water and solving the problems that are there. That's the number one issue. The second issue for me is that our politics have become unbelievably hateful and partisan, and it's time to change the dialogue so it's not just between two parties that hate one another and are more focused on winning than they are on solving the problems.
Well, let's look at a priority of yours, protecting our children's future. What do you mean by that?
Well, the overwhelming existential threat is environmental destruction and climate change, and it needs to be addressed at every level, beginning at the local level, the state level, and nationally. So there's evidence that ocean life is dying in huge numbers. There's evidence, I'm a beekeeper, bees are dying. There's evidence that we're seeing massive species die-off. The species that pollinate our food are in danger. Our food supply is in danger. Our water is in danger. So these are things that are not going to be solved quickly, but they're not solved by ignoring them. So that's my number one issue, but it's certainly not the only one.
What environmental challenges do you see specifically in Wisconsin that you would want to address if elected as governor?
Well, starting with Wisconsin, I think there are serious issues with lead in our water system. For example, in Milwaukee, there are issues of heavy metals showing up in our groundwater. There are issues related to massive pig farms and other sources of potential solution that are not being carefully regulated. There is evidence that the current administration prefers support to business over protecting the environment, Foxconn being one example. And so the first thing that I would do as governor is I would put science back in the DNR, and I would have government agents start to assess what the threats are and what are our most immediate priorities. The next thing I would do is make that transparent so that the people are aware of what the problems are, and then we begin to prioritize how we address them.
You mentioned the DNR. What other changes would you make to the DNR if elected governor? Walk us through them.
Well, I hate it when people ask really good questions that I haven't thought well enough in detail. So I think that the first thing I would do is focus on doing an assessment of what the priorities are across the state. Are they mining issues? Are they water pollution issues? Are they protecting our wetlands? Are they protecting natural resources? The truth is that I don't think we know, and the first thing to do is assess what the state is, the state of the state, if you will, and get politics out of it entirely. So it's not about political party versus another party. It's what the science says.
What is the Green New Deal?
Well, that was a phrase that was coined by Jill Stein. She's not the first one to say it. But the Green New Deal is a recognition that we have to protect jobs, we have to protect the economies of the people in the state, and I believe that as we transition to a sustainable economy, for example, an economy that's not as dependent upon fossil fuels, that's not as dependent upon coal, that is using other sources of energy, that there are opportunities there for job creation, for business creation. Another example is that the current parties, by and large, are ignoring the disenfranchised and the poorest members of society, and the Green New Deal would find a way to address that. it's a phrase that I didn't coin, but I think there's some important principles behind it. We need an inclusive society as opposed to my side versus your side. So I think that's about as specific as I can get at the moment.
Dr. Michael White is the Green Party candidate for governor of Wisconsin. What's the top issue you want the next governor to focus on? What questions do you have for Dr. White? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. White, we know that health care is on the minds of Wisconsinites. If elected, what would you change, given the current state of health care in the Badger State?
I am really glad you asked that question. So I am a dermatologist. I practice taking care of patients every day. And the first thing that I would do is address the issues of drug costs. So I'm going to give you a couple of examples. There is a cheap topical steroid. Well, it used to be cheap. That cost our pharmacy $9 in change of September of 2014. That's what it cost the pharmacy to buy a tube. 3 months later, the cost was $175, simply because the drug company could raise prices. The biologics that you see advertised on television for psoriasis, they're all wonderful drugs. I have seen them change people's lives. But the average cost of those medicines is 50% more than the median income in the part of the state that I live. So drug costs that are out of control, drug companies that can charge whatever they want, the Medicaid and Medicare and insurance plans having no ability to basically control those price, I think are things that can be worked on. I would work to make sure that we extend Badger Care as much as possible, that we make sure that some form of affordable health care is available to everybody in the state, that we don't have an unacceptably high number of people with no insurance. We also can't have our insurance programs bankrupting the companies. So these won't be easy solutions, but the current system is not working when we have huge numbers of people that can't even afford basic medicine. So I would start with drug costs. I would work with the state government. I would then offer to work with other state governments and explore the nonprofit drug consortiums that are being created between state governments and healthcare organizations. Don't misunderstand me. I love the research that the drug companies do because they advance the quality of our healthcare. But some of those drugs are so pricey that they're only available to a few, and the people that need them can't get them, especially when they hit 65.
What about rural health care? We hear a lot about how difficult it is to find health care in rural Wisconsin. What would you do when it comes to rural health care?
Well, I think that we have issues with our small hospitals and our small clinics closing throughout rural Wisconsin. I live 15 miles from the nearest stoplight. I live out in the country, so I hear from my neighbors about what those issues are. And I think the first thing to do is make sure we provide the level of support for the rural hospitals and the rural clinics to make sure they're adequately supported. We also need to address health care for the inner city where it is often not available, like grocery stores are not available, et cetera. We need to address the First Peoples, our Native Americans, that don't have adequate access to health care. And so I think the governor has a limited ability to make things happen. She or he must lead and must put the issues out in front of the state legislatures, the other bodies that can make change, so that they are pressured to do something about it. There's, I think, relatively little that the governor can do by writing executive orders. The main ability there is to make the issue public, to put it on the table, and to hold accountable our assembly and our state senate.
A Green Party candidate, Michael White, stays with us, and we want to hear from you. What's the top issue you think the next governor needs to deal with? 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. In this installment of our series of interviews with Wisconsin candidates for governor, we're talking with Dr. Michael White, the Green Party candidate. He's running against Libertarian Phil Anderson, Wisconsin Party candidate Arne Enns, Democrat Tony Evers, Independent candidate Maggie Turnbull, and Republican incumbent Scott Walker. What's the top issue you want the next governor to deal with? What questions do you have for Dr. Michael White? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. White, we have a caller who wants to join it and our conversation. She has a question for you. Jackie is with us in Baraboo. Jackie, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
I am, okay, wonderful. I am concerned about DACA. We have thousands of young people across the state of Wisconsin who want to get a driver's license, who want to get a job and pay taxes, who want to go to college to better their lives. What can we do to help these people realize the American dream?
Dr. White?
So I think her question is an excellent one. I think that DACA needs to be addressed. We've been pushing it down the road without paying attention to people that have lived here, in some cases, virtually their entire lives and have contributed to our society and are already paying taxes. Some of them have gone so far as to join the military, and I understand now we're kicking them out of the military. I served in the military, and for immigrants, people in the Philippines were able to join the military as non-U.S. citizens, and it was a path to the American dream. So I think that we owe it to these people to find a way to get them permanent status and citizenship. I honestly don't know the mechanics that a state can do, but I would support with other states and with our legislatures pushing back against the hate that is rising in this country, and it's directed against immigrants. Immigrants are what built this country, and immigrants are the future of pulling us together and getting away from the partisanship. So I would support doing something about DACA, protecting those people, letting them pay taxes, letting them go to school, getting them health care, letting them become productive members of our society. It's a good question.
Jackie, thanks for your question. I'd like to turn to education. Funding education has been a huge issue in Wisconsin for years. What are your ideas about how we fund education in Wisconsin?
Another excellent question. I think the devil's in the details. I would argue that we have a problem that we fund education primarily through property tax, and rich districts have more money to spend and more support for their basic students and for their basic systems than poor districts. There are state programs and federal programs designed to provide additional aid, but it's not clear to me that those are working. And so the first place I would look is to see, can those state programs be improved, assisted? Can we funnel more money into them? The next thing is the issue of vouchers and charter schools. I think vouchers are a mistake because vouchers allow people that have mobility and choice to move out of any school district to go to any other school district that they want to or to go to a private school. The very people that need the schools the most are the ones that are left behind in a school district that is struggling. So I think our public schools are the road to bringing us together and improving the overall health and welfare of the whole society, and those need to be supported and improved, and we need to do everything we can to do that. That's going to need money, and that money's got to come from somewhere, and that needs a public discussion.
Let's turn to higher education. If elected, do you envision any changes there?
I'm not sure, in all honesty, because I haven't looked enough at that issue closely. I do believe, from what I've been hearing from administrators at our public universities and colleges, that some programs have been well-funded and others have not, that our funding has been stagnant, that the cost of education, more importantly, the cost of the loans for the students, is an impediment to people getting high education. That's part of the Green New Deal that Jill Stein was talking about, is addressing the cost of education, finding a way to change the way it's funded, to forgive loans in many cases, or at least make them affordable so that people can pay them off. People should not own the equivalent of a house before they get their first job.
According to an audit of the State Department of Transportation in 2017, about a third of Wisconsin state highways were in fair, poor, or worse condition than in 2015. And a report from transportation research group TRIP, released a month ago, showed that half of major locally and state-maintained roads and highways in the state rate as poor or mediocre. What do you see as solutions to repairing and investing in Wisconsin's roads?
So I drive over some of those roads every day. Like I said, I drive 15 miles to the nearest traffic light. So I know what those roads are like. La Crosse County, which is where I live, just sent out a flyer to the entire county about an advisory referendum. And the choices available to us in La Crosse County boil down to three that they're offering. One is that we raise the cost of license fees for trucks and cars and use those added revenues to pay for the roads. Another one is that we put a new tax out. We tax all the visitors coming in and using our roads, those nasty visitors, and we charge more taxes to the businesses that are driven off tourism. And the third is that we borrow money. We kick the can down the road. I think that if we look at those as mutually exclusive, none of them are good choices. We're going to have to allocate more money for roads and transportation and bridges and railroads, and we're going to have to get that money somehow. I think the answer is going to be a combination of perhaps an increase in vehicle tax, perhaps an increase in what they call the resort tax, and maybe borrowing some money. But we need to do it in a way that's transparent, and we get the populace to weigh in on these are our choices, give us your input, and then the state legislature needs to put the interests of the people ahead of the interests of corporate America and start taking care of our infrastructure.
Are you open to tolling?
Yes.
Are there solutions outside those that we've discussed?
I think there are. I think that we've missed the boat on rapid transit when it was available. We had a light rail system that Governor Walker vetoed that would have provided considerably more jobs than Foxconn and would have provided considerable income stream long term and would have taken some of the traffic off the roads. So I think in those places where light rail and other mass transit is possible, we should investigate that as well. I think that there may be new ways to fund the roads that we haven't thought about. I would support legalization of cannabis, for example. And legalization of cannabis would provide an opportunity of another revenue stream that could be directed first to education and secondly to roads. I think we're going to need to raise more money, but we can't afford to drive our businesses into bankruptcy.
Let's take a quick call from Tina, who joins us from Watertown. Tina, hello.
Good morning. I love this Green Party candidate. I wish the Green Party had more visibility and money to get this message out on every issue. He checks all the boxes of common sense government reforms that we so desperately need. My question is about the openness and transparency of government that has not occurred for the last 8 years and the effect of Citizens United. What would you do to help people instead of companies have more power with their donations? Because now we have a flood of dark money donations. Second question is, has the Green Party and the Libertarian Party candidate ever considered doing what this woman in a third party in Arizona did in the Senate race, which is, and I hate to say this, but drop out of the race, throw your support behind Tony Evers so we can once and for all get rid of this corrupt government. That
all right, Tina, we're running out of time. We get it. Dr. White?
Well, there's a lot of loaded questions there that I love. First of all, people, planet, and principle before profit. I would work to get all corporate money out of pocket, out of politics. Your vote should count a lot more than any corporation's. Transparency is number one. I want to compliment the Wisconsin Election Commission as the result of the recount, which Jill Stein asked for and which thousands of people across the country paid for. The Wisconsin Election Commission is changing our election so that this November, 5% of all of the ballots of the precincts will be hand-counted as a risk-limiting audit before the votes are certified. That's an effort to improve the integrity of our election, the transparency of our election, and I want to state that it happened because of Jill Stein, not because of the Democrats or the Republicans. Have I considered dropping out? No. We don't have enough time to talk about it, but I would love to talk about it in detail.
Is Wisconsin ready to elect a governor from outside of one of the two major parties?
Oh, heck no. They're not ready at all. And that's the problem that we have right now is our two parties are becoming so polarized. It's all about winning, and it's not about doing the right thing. Robert Kagan, a prominent neoconservative, wrote in 2016 that we are in danger that the people in a democracy, excited, angry, and unconstrained, might run roughshod over even the institutions created to preserve their freedoms. If you look at all of the polls, we're getting more and more polarized. So people would argue we take money away, we take votes away from the Democrats. That's not true. We bring new votes in, and we bring a more moderate voice in, because the two sides are getting so busy beating themselves about the head, beating each other up. They're more focused on winning than they are on taking care of the people. As a Green governor, I could work with Democrats and Republicans and Independents and the Libertarians in a civil way.
All right, Dr. White, the Green Party candidate for governor of Wisconsin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, John.
Visit WisconsinVote.org to hear all of our candidate interviews. Wisconsin Public Radio invited every statewide candidate and everyone running for Congress to talk with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm John Munson. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Overmatched by America's conventional military might, countries like North Korea, Russia, China, and Iran have found us vulnerable to attack in cyberspace. Today, as our entire economy goes digital, from banking to manufacturing to transportation to operating your refrigerator, the potential targets for our enemies multiply. It's cyber war. The question is, how are we fighting it? What questions do you have about America's cyber defenses? What should we do to protect ourselves from hackers? And what are your concerns about cyber threats from other world powers? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. John P. Carlin is author of the book Dawn of the Code War, America's Battle Against Russia, China, and the Rising Global Cyber Threat. He's a career federal prosecutor and the former Assistant Attorney General for National Security. John, welcome to the morning show.
Thanks, John.
You begin your book with the story of Junaid Hussein. How is he is an example of how young people are radicalized online?
Yeah, and it started with that story because as I've gone around helping clients in this space, I realized how many people did not realize that there had already been a case where an individual stole information from a U.S. company with a trusted brand name, a retail company, stole personal information from customers, and then threatened them with ransomware and said, essentially, give me $500. Or else I'll embarrass you by making this information public. That happens to companies all across the country every day. What made this case so unusual, though, and is why cyber is so different from other types of threats, is exactly what you mentioned, which is on the other end of the keyboard across the world was an extremist from Kosovo who had moved to Malaysia named Farizi. And really, he moved to Malaysia in part because they had better broadband access, believe it or not. And he was an extremist and did want that $500, but on the back end, he had become friends with a British citizen who had been arrested for computer hacking, radicalized while in prison, and had moved from London to Raqqa, Syria, where he was located at the very heart of the Islamic State of the Levant. And his name was Junaid Hussein. And what we were seeing at the time in terrorism cases across the country was that Junaid Hussein was at the tip of a spear of a new approach to terror that the Islamic State in the Levant had adopted. After years and billions of dollars in new departments and agencies, we had gotten very good at disrupting al-Qaeda's old strategy, where they tried to get operatives, get recruits, bring them into Afghanistan, Pakistan, train them, and deploy them to commit a terrorist act on the scale of September 11th. And there, on September 11th, they used Western technology against us, aviation, to cause the death of innocents. What we were seeing, though, with the Islamic State in the Levant, led by Junaid Hussein and his cohort, was they were taking advantage of Western technology, too. But the Western technology they were taking advantage of was social media. And what they had learned was they could reach directly into our houses and our basements to reach young people, troubled people, and try to convert them into essentially human weapons. They were crowdsourcing terrorism. And what happened was Junaid Hussein, located in Raqqa, Syria, became friends with Farizi, who was located in Malaysia. And Junaid Hussein convinced Farizi to take the information that he had stolen from this U.S. company, that customer information that was entrusted to him, and give it to him. And what Junaid Hussein did when he got a hold of that stolen information was he could care less about the $500 through Bitcoin. What he wanted to do was kill. And so what he did is he culled that list to see who looks like they're a U.S. government employee, who's got a .edu or a .gov. He created that kill list, and then again, using Western technology provided to him for free, Twitter, he blasted that list back to the United States and said, kill these people by name, by address, where they live, using information trusted from the company. I think that shows why it was top of my list as the top national security lawyer as a threat. It's new. I mean, think about that alone. It crosses five different countries. It's multiple nationalities. And it puts the private sector on the front lines of national security threats like terrorism in a way that never has been there before. It's also a good example of the way that we fight back. The reason I can go into so many details in the book about that case is because we found Farizi in Malaysia. We arrested him with cooperation of the Malaysians. He was extradited back to the United States and sentenced to 20 years in prison in 2016, while Junaid, who was outside the reach of American law enforcement, was killed in a publicly acknowledged military strike by Central Command.
Lone wolf attacks are categorized as not orchestrated by organized terrorist networks, but by independent individuals. You say they don't really exist. What do you mean?
Well, we often find the so-called lone wolf has people who knew about or encouraged their radicalization. And either they have them in the real world, in the physical world, or they're meeting people online. And either it's terrorists like Junaid Hussein who are specifically targeting them, or they're entering echo chambers of radicalization and hate where they slowly start to believe that it's okay to move from an idea to violence. And that, by the way, is not something you just see with terrorist groups or nation states who try to exploit it. As the tragedy that we saw in Pittsburgh shows, it can also happen to those who are motivated by some domestic ideology. The key is trying to identify those people before the violence occurs so that you can reach them and prevent it from happening.
What's the goal? What's your goal with this book?
My goal is that we are already in a code war. And what I mean by that is there's a low-intensity conflict where every day, whether it's terrorists taking information to create kill lists, nation states stealing information, billions and billions of dollars in what the former director of National Security Agency, General Keith Alexander, called the largest transfer of wealth in human history, or disruptive attacks, like the attacks to undermine our election, is to make sure people know that, number one, what is already happening. Number two, that we can change this dynamic before something really serious happens once we're educated about what the threats are. And number three, in the interim, before we make big changes, there's a lot of valuable lessons to be learned about the way we caught and disrupted people that can help protect you right now.
How is the cyber threat intensifying as we move more of our lives online?
Yeah, when you think about it, over a 25, 30-year period, we moved almost everything we value from books and papers, from analog to digital. And we did so without really thinking through what the risks are. And that's true in government and the private sector. And now we're playing catch-up because we see things like massive thefts of credit card and names and address information. We see things like the North Korean attack on Sony because they didn't like the content of a movie they made. That's where we are right now. as we look at where we're going to be, we're right on the cusp of really a revolution where we connect billions of new devices through the same insecure protocol, the internet. It just was never designed with security primarily in mind. And these new devices are physical. So we've already had instances, for example, of the pacemakers in our hearts that have been put inside people's bodies. And after they put the pacemaker in the body, they realized, hey, we tested to see whether this works. But what we didn't do is test to see whether it's safe if someone didn't want it to work, a crook, a terrorist, or a spy. And because it was rolled out without security in mind, they could see that an 11-year-old with publicly available software could hack and kill. Now, after realizing that and after the pacemaker was in people's hearts, they pushed out a patch. But, you know, think about, for your listeners out there and all of us, how many times we've had our computers stop working because it needed a patch. When it's the pacemaker in your heart or the car on our road or the drone in our sky, that's not good enough. So I think we're at a real inflection point where if we speak out to those who represent us, to our companies, we can get them to build security by design in before we start connecting all these physical devices.
John Carlin is the author of the book Dawn of the Code War, America's Battle Against Russia, China, and the Rising Global Cyber Threat. He's a career federal prosecutor and the former Assistant Attorney General for National Security. How has the FBI tracking of potential threats changed since the Internet became prominent?
You know, in some ways, the FBI was created a federal law enforcement agency because of the advent of highways. It meant that people crossed state lines easily, and we needed a new approach to law enforcement. I think the Internet is having as profound an effect on the role and job of the FBI. I went over, after being a career prosecutor focusing on the criminal side of computer hacking cases, to the FBI to be chief of staff to then director of the FBI, Bob Mueller. And when I went over there, for the first time, I was able to see what was happening on the intelligence side of the house. And this was relatively recent. And what I saw was an amazing intelligence feat using national security methods where we could literally watch China in particular go into places like universities, hop through the internet from the university to private businesses, and then we literally, they had a graphic user interface so you could see a visual. We'd watch this information, trade secrets, intellectual property, negotiation tactics flow out of the United States, billions of dollars. And it became clear that this was not an intelligence problem. This was something that needed to be disrupted now. And I think you've seen the FBI move to that approach.
John Carlin, we'll continue our conversation in just a moment. What questions do you have about America's cyber defenses? 800-642-1234. Your calls next on The Morning Show. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Well, I guess we're all on the front lines in this new global conflict called cyber war. We're in a cyber war. The question is, what are we doing about it? What questions do you have about America's cyber defenses? 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. John Carlin is author of the book Dawn of the Code War, America's Battle Against Russia, China, and the Rising Global Cyber Threat. He's a career federal prosecutor, former attorney general for national security. We do have phone calls. Let's start with Jess in Appleton. Jess, welcome to The Morning Show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Go ahead.
Hi, I just want to make a comment. I'm a developer, and what I'm noticing in multiple companies that I've worked for, one of the things that we could do is raise awareness a little bit more about cybersecurity and security in general, and that's among all departments. That's among the developers. That's among anybody who doesn't even want to work with a computer.
Uh-oh. I think we lost him. All right. I think we got enough there, John, to kind of get an idea of where that question was going.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with your caller more. I think one of the key reforms I'd recommend is that everyone get educated. We're so dependent on cybersecurity that really it's wrong to call it cybersecurity. It's just security. It's what our economy depends on. It's what our health system depends on. So that means things like, I know, for instance, my daughter, when she was learning to read, she tried to swipe the page before we explained to her that's not how you read. So for kids who are going to be that engaged in the digital world, it should be in public school education across the country that you have a basic awareness of how to be safe online. And then that extends up. For instance, right now at some of our top universities like MIT, you don't learn cybersecurity as part of the basic curriculum. It's an elective. But everyone who codes should be taught about the dangers of cybersecurity. And the third issue is it's just a great opportunity for those looking for jobs, because there's an enormous skills gap between what our executives and business leaders are saying they need and the current skills of our workforce. So we need initiatives to help retrain people who want to get into this field.
What role can Silicon Valley play in our cyber defenses?
They are so on the front lines in a variety of ways. We talked a little bit about the way terrorists have exploited social media, and we saw Russia do the same thing. And to a different extent, Iran recently, Facebook talked about how they were putting out essentially fake news to try to exacerbate tensions inside the United States. So Silicon Valley companies can help come up with the technology to stop and prevent that type of behavior. And also, long term, I hope innovate our way out of this problem. You know, as dependent as we are now on our iPhones and laptops, many of us remember an age not too long ago where that was not the case. So maybe we can innovate our way into a more secure technology.
Let's take another call. Matt joins us from Hartford. Matt, hello.
Hello. I'm just wondering, since a lot of times what is old is new again, what is the FBI's, task force or whatever, on protecting our critical information like nuclear secrets and things like that? I'm just worried that this focus on individual cybersecurity might draw away from that. I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Matt, thanks for the question. John Carlin?
I think that's exactly right, Matt. So the first priority has been critical infrastructure. So a focus on how to protect against those who would go after our nuclear power, our electrical grid, our water supply. Remember one case that we brought that we talk about in the book of Iranian hackers linked to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, who we had indicted for attacking our financial system, 47 different financial institutions, but they also had hacked into the Bowman Dam in Rye, New York. And what they did is they accessed the sluice control systems so they'd be able to lift up the dam and flood the surrounding area. Now, it happens the dam was down for physical maintenance at the time, but none of us felt good that crumbling physical infrastructure was going to be our best defense against cyber attacks. So I think it was a good lesson at how we need to protect critical infrastructure. The other thing we learned, though, to Matt's question, is sometimes what we value most is not a thing. So we spend a lot of our laws, regulations, and approach were built about around that infrastructure. But one thing from the North Korean attack on Sony Motion Pictures, we wargamed for years what it would look like if a rogue nuclear-armed nation tried to attack the United States through cyber means. And we never imagined that it would be about a movie about a bunch of pot smokers. It's the only time in my career I went to brief the president in the Situation Room and had to start by giving a plot summary. And for those of you that have seen The Interview, it's not an easy movie to summarize because it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's a comedy. So the reason why we took that so seriously, though, is it wasn't an attack on the movie. It was an attack on the right to free speech, a core value in the United States that was being meddled with by a regime overseas that doesn't share our values. And we saw the same type of attack on our system, in this case, democracy, with the Russian attempts to interfere in our election. So as we think about what's critical infrastructure and what the FBI's priorities need to be, it needs to be not just the things or stuff, but also attacks on our core values and systems.
Just yesterday, the Justice Department charged three people and two Chinese companies with theft of trade secrets from an Idaho-based technology company. In addition, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced a new initiative to combat this kind of cyber theft. Is this initiative a step in the right direction to protect our economy from cyber war?
Yeah, I think the initiative that the Attorney General announced is a step in the right direction, and it's a continuation of the story that we're telling in the book, where the first case we brought against uniformed members of the Chinese military was just in 2014. It was a unit called 61398, and we laid out how that unit's day job, they got up every morning, went to work in their uniform, their day job was to hack into American companies solely for economic benefit. And we showed with an attachment in the case that that conduct started at 9 in the morning Beijing time, went from 9 to noon. They took a one-hour lunch break because the activity decreased from noon to 1, up again in Hacken from 1 to 6, decreased overnight, weekends and Chinese holidays. And the prosecutor in me calls that circumstantial evidence. But the broader point is that means the second largest military in the world is targeting private companies. And if they're left on their own to deal with that, they can't. They don't have the resources. So the initiative that is going to be spearheaded by my successor in my old division says we're going to use all tools, criminal prosecutions, civil suits, Treasury Department sanctions, Commerce Department authorities to increase the cost of that type of economic theft until the conduct changes.
As you know, there's a big election coming up next Tuesday. As we go forward, how do we as a country ensure that our elections are free from foreign interference?
That's why it's so important to learn and study and know these stories about what's already happened in the past. Once you do, you can come up with creative ways to protect yourself. I use the example of the French president, Macron, was running, and he saw what Russia did in our 2016 election. He knew they were going to come for his campaign and hack into it. What his campaign did was, knowing the bad guy is going to be inside the system, they deliberately put email traffic in that was not true. And then when predictably the Russian hackers stole and released that information to try to embarrass them, they told the mainstream media, Hey, guys, if we're not going to tell you what's true or not true, so if you publish this, you won't know. And it worked. It kept them from publishing it. He successfully won the presidency. That's a good lesson for all of us in business and the private sector. You know, if you assume that there's no wall you can build that's high enough to keep a dedicated intruder out of your system, then don't put the things you value most in a folder called crown jewels, right? Bad idea.
And John Carlin, we'll have to leave it there. We're out of time. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
John Carlin is the author of the book Dawn of the Code War, America's Battle Against Russia, China, and the Rising Global Cyber Threat. He's a career federal prosecutor and former assistant attorney general for national security. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.